Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening to my friends on the east, and good afternoon to my friends on the west. Welcome to Empire State Reptiles Live. My name is Chris, and I have the pleasure of being your host for today's show. We have somebody very, very special. We've been working on getting on the show for a little while. We planned this a month back, and I know some of you guys know about what's going on tonight. So tonight's our last show for the year, so there will be no more shows for the 2016 year until January 7th, where we will be back here with Imperial Supergiants at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you guys know that. So we'll talk about that more. Our special guest, Mr. John from Sobolo Cartel. How are you doing?
Hey, Chris. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I'm doing well. Thank you for agreeing to come on this crazy show. So first I want to talk a little bit about what you read and how you got started with what you do. So what are you reading? What are you working with over there?
I've actually downsized quite a bit as far as the number of species go. I was working a couple, you know, probably this time last year, I was probably 50, 60 species. My main focus is within the genus Eubuffus, also Goniosaurus, or a lot of people know them as cave geckos, but working with all the different species there. But I'm mainly working with your common leopard gecko, the different morphs and stuff, and then also the wild types and the species of Eubuffus, which are like your leopard geckos. But most people don't realize that there are a few different species. They just think the leopard gecko is a leopard gecko, but there's actually not only the subspecies that we, you know, have been common in the hobby for a little while, but there's also species like Eubuffus angamanu, which is typically is farther towards the west. Most leopard geckos are macularis. Well, macularis is the common species of leopard gecko, and so those are throughout Pakistan, India, like northern India, up all the way up until the Himalayas, and then Afghanistan, a little bit into Iran towards the east, and then through the Zagros Mountains up into Syria and Turkey, there's Eubuffus angamanu. So I work with a few different localities of those. I also work with the Indian species, which are Eubuffus huscus and Eubuffus hardwicki. So hardwicki's on the east side for the most part, and Fuscus is on the west of India. So,
all right.
I work with all those and all the morphs of the leopard geckos. So that's kind of like the main bread and butter of the business. So, but yeah.
All right. So just a question for you. So when breeding different species of the leopard geckos, subspecies as you call them, so do you see a difference in the outcome of your breeding practices with them? Or do you see a difference on the patterns on them? Can you explain that to some of our viewers that listeners that don't really know about those?
Yeah, so subspecies refer to the stuff that's within macularis. And so macularis has quote-unquote subspecies. A lot of them are, you know, the science on them isn't very good at this point, so we don't really some of them really probably aren't just subspecies or just localities or something, but regardless, they are what they are, and they're pure wild types of some sort. So we have like the fasciolatus and the montanus and the afghanicus and the different ones. So they work good. The reason I keep them, and the main reason for keeping them in general for breeders, I think, is to be able to outcross your normal leopard geckos. So if you have different genetics and stuff, you want to diversify the bloodline, or what I usually use them for is for test breeding. So you can breed, they're a clean slate basically. So you can breed an animal to them and know that they're a clean slate going forward. So Yeah, but they do have influence, of course. Anything you breed will have influence on whatever you breed it to. So a lot of them have kind of more of a snow-like appearance. I think because these were hand-selected out of wild-caught shipments, that they probably selected the ones that look a little more like snows or have a little bit of lighter coloration for the most part. So most of them tend to you know, remove the color and kind of lighten things up when you breed them into normal leopard geckos.
Yeah. Since you work with a wide range of leopard geckos, what tends to be your favorite? What really catches your eyes? So when you go to NARBC or Tenley Park, you know, all the reptile shows out there, what do you go in looking for?
I've always been into line breeding stuff for the most part. I'm getting even farther away from doing all the combo morphs and stuff like that. And you can have like a base morph, like a Murphy Patternless or a Blizzard or whatever, but you can still line breed it.
Yeah.
And I always like color. So like tangerines have probably always been one of my go-tos as far as, yeah, color and pattern. I mean, like bolds and tangerines and, you know, I like mixing them with stuff, but I don't like doing the super combos of like mixing a bunch of, you know, recessives and codons and doms together and trying to make this new combo of all that stuff. Usually it ends up being kind of boring and basic, and then there's sometimes genetic issues, and then, you know, for me that's not that interesting. And then once you get there, what do you go? There's nowhere to go from there. You just produce the same thing. So I like keeping it more simple and just working on color and the purity of the lines, not having too many genetics mixed in there. I'll take a base morph for something like white and yellow and add tangerine to it and try to make the best white and yellow tangerine out there. And, you know, honestly, those are the most beautiful geckos anyway. So
yeah, definitely.
Kind of what I've stuck to.
So you've definitely heard about the Enigma syndrome. And, you know, there's rumors out there about, since you brought up white and yellow, there's rumors out there about the white and yellow syndrome. So how do you encounter, have you ever encountered something different with your white and yellows or experienced white and yellow syndrome? Since most people think it's almost like a rumor or a myth, it's mythical. So some people have it, some people don't.
Well,
so
I did a big note on this on my Facebook page. So I wrote up an article regarding this whole thing. That's kind of, I think, part of the reason it's floating around a lot right now. But through my experience, I have seen lines of white and yellow that just never show the problem. So there'll be like, I'll have a, like in my entire bell line, for instance, I've had it from day one, and I've never seen one animal come out with that problem. First of all, it's very different from Enigma syndrome. Like Enigma syndrome has a problem with the gecko having balance issues and different things like that. But it is definitely a very different neuro issue going on there. White and yellow syndrome is actually seen in other, you can pop out that same problem in other, you know, non-white and yellow geckos, and it can happen other places, but it definitely is in some of the lines out there. And from what I've seen, and I mean, I don't have, you know, ultimate say on this so far. I don't have, you know, perfect record or perfect, you know, scientific study regarding this or anything like that, but from what I see, it can be bred out. So, and you can breed, you know, if you're just holding back like the ones that don't have the syndrome or the issue, you can still have it come out of the line. But once it's out of a line, from what I see, it's not in there anymore. So you can hatch 10, you know, white and yellows that just don't show it very much or don't show it at all even, and then the 11 will have it there. But from my experience, it just shows that whole line has it at that point. So once it's out completely and just produce, you know, tons of white and yellows without it, you can pretty safely call it that line clean from it, and it won't come back from what I've seen so far. You know, I'm not saying this is definite.
So you're saying the main symptom of the white and yellow syndrome is basically almost like the Enigma syndrome with the wobble. Is there any other things that are add-on to the white and yellow syndrome that differs it from the Enigma syndrome?
It's not as pronounced, for sure. You know, some of them, when they hatch, they can be pretty bad. they can be falling over almost sometimes. But it tends to get better with age. And, you know, whereas Enigma syndrome typically gets worse with age. You know, it starts off, it can be bad at any point, but a lot of times for females especially, they'll go through a stressful period of laying eggs or whatever it is. And sometimes they just go downhill. You know, I know there's people that say they have enigmas that they don't have any syndrome, but you know, I just always say, just show me the video, because I don't believe it. I've worked with them enough over the years that, you know, it's always there. Even if it's good or the gecko doesn't have a lot of the problem, it still can come out in the babies and manifest itself. And I worked on trying to line breed it out using wild types and all kinds of stuff. And it will never disconnect from the actual gene. Whereas from what I see, white and yellow can definitely be disconnected from it. So it can actually be separated. It takes some work and it's not necessarily easy, but it can be.
But it can be.
For white and yellow.
So would you definitely recommend white and yellows, not only as pets, but as somebody that wants to start off in the leopard gecko breeding community, would you recommend starting off with the white and yellow, since now people are starting to see that white and yellow syndrome and are identifying it? So would you recommend that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even work with enigmas anymore, just because it's been an issue as a breeder and selling to hobbyists out there. I mean, I think I did my last refund on Enigma in like 2014 or 15, and you know, just happy to be done with it, you know, because it's always an issue. And I don't knock anybody that breeds them. That's up to them. And, you know, you just got to disclose the issues to other breeders. But it always ends up, you know, being some people, you know, when you're dealing with general public or, you know, other people that you're selling to, you're going to have some people that don't mind the problem and others that really, you know, have a problem with it. And I didn't like it. And I won't, you know, you couldn't even give me an enigma anymore, to be honest. So for me, it's just something I'm not even going to work with anymore. White and yellow, on the other hand, I think there's, like I said, you can separate it from that problem. Even if the problem's there,
potential.
It's just not as bad either. And it can be even kept with those issues. But the fact that it can be separated and we can work on it to have a clean, you know, clean lines of them going forward is, you know, I love them. You know, they really make the colors pop, and they're nice gene to work with, but
definitely.
It's nice to know that they can be separated out later.
Yeah. So I would like to talk a little bit about a new type of boom in the leopard gecko breeding world. It's just this one particular color of a leopard gecko that has seemed to pick up momentum in the last 2 to 3 years, I would say. It's the black leopard gecko. So you guys call it the black pearl. So how did that black pearl project come to be?
Well, there's two main ones that are commonly known in the hobby, and there's the black pearl and then there's black knight. Whereas the black knight comes out of Europe from a Dutch breeder. And then those have been what you've been commonly seeing in the last couple of years. And those are basically, I forgot how many years it is. I think it's 14 or 15 years of line breeding some wild types to get them dark like that, from what I understand. Not all of them are dark. They can breed non-dark animals, but you can also get dark ones from it. And they, from what I know, they're legitimately pretty black. Couple of issues, though, I find is, you know, line breeding something that to that extent can kind of become a problem for the animal's genetics. I mean, reptiles are good at interbreeding, or, you know, maintaining strength through interbreeding. But when you do it for that long, you kind of narrow down the gene pool, and it kind of can become an issue. But, you know, they're still nice, and, you know, they can be worked into other stuff probably. I work with black pearls, and I do have a black knight female, but I work with black pearls. I have a pretty large group of those. There might be one other breeder, maybe two, that actually have dark ones that they're producing, maybe not even that. They basically went up to a breeder in Canada originally.
Okay.
He paid a lot of money for them, and he sold off, I think, most of the visuals. This is my understanding of the story off the top of my head, but he sold off the visuals.
Okay.
and then kept the he bought it as a recessive gene, and I don't think it's proved out to be that.
Okay.
But yeah, it doesn't necessarily work like that though. So he sold off all the visuals and then kept all the quote unquote hets and tried to breed those together.
Oh,
and
okay.
I think for whatever reason he lost the project in this thing. But the quote unquote hets never produced any or something like that. I think he might have kept one or visual that died or something to that extent. The guys he sold the visuals, I think he sold like two females off to two different breeders in the U.S. One of these breeders bred it into charcoals, which is JMG, and they bred it into their darker line of like, kind of like a hypoed out dark line, and they bred that's called charcoal. They bred it into those, and then another. I'm not sure if it went all to JMG and then it went to another breeder named Paul Allen. But either way, Paul Allen got some, and then he was producing the dark ones himself. I had gotten some from JMG back then as well, so I'd been working with some of those crosses as well. I hadn't really produced any dark ones. But anyway, long story short, they went to Sasselbeck and then to Davis Fine Geckos, and then I got Davis Fine Geckos group this last year. And they're producing black ones now. So whatever it is, you know, it kind of seems to be a line bred thing that just randomly pops out of certain animals. I'll know more in the future, but, you know, right now it's producing dark ones, and I'm holding back all the dark ones and going to be breeding those together. So going forward, it should, you know, hopefully save that line of dark geckos, which, you know, a lot of people, I like them, you know, I don't, I think tendrils and other things are better for me, but, you know, a lot of people love them and willing to pay kind of ridiculous prices for them. So, you know, they're definitely something going forward. We'll see over the next couple of years.
So you were saying that before we got more in depth into the conversation, you were saying something about you ran into a couple of issues with the black pearls. So what were those issues that you encountered?
I didn't run it. Oh, with my own line. Well, I just never produced really dark ones. So I had a black pearl charcoal line that I got from JMG directly. And it seems like you have to get lucky when you get some of these babies to produce some that actually produce dark ones. So, you know, my line, it was starting to get dark. I was line breeding them darker, but it had been 3 or 4 years where, you know, I just, by getting this group from David, I kind of stepped up the project a couple levels for sure. And some of these guys, some of the babies coming out are really dark. So, but
all right,
there's what I was saying with the Black Knights, which is a different line. I was just saying the inbreeding possibly could be an issue. You know, if there's not enough diversity there, and you know, the second you outcross these, you know, they lose their color for the most part. You know, I don't know. Some of them may keep the color, and you know, I know. I've seen some positive results in the U.S. from some crosses, so maybe that can be worked on. But
so, have you ever tried to outcross the black pearls yet, or have you just?
Well, the black pearls were
pretty
much out. They were outcrossed when they were bred to that charcoal, and then you know Matt from Sasselbeck actually outcrossed them too, so some Max Snow stuff as well. So they have been outcrossed quite a bit. I mean, they're not they're still a line, so they're going to have some interbreeding, but you know, they definitely have, they don't have 15 generations of interbreeding, you know, so
definitely not.
It's definitely become a little bit more stable as far as genetics go and the line and stuff. So should be interesting. And I'm going to cross the two lines together probably this next year. So we'll see what black pearl to black knight produces too. So
we're excited.
We'll see
what we see come out of that. Yeah. So, we actually just got a question into that contact form. I'm not sure why you guys submit questions into our contact form. It's not a really good way. You're lucky I just happened to check it and ask your question on air. So the question comes from an Instagrammer. They asked not to disclose their name, whatever, from an Instagrammer, and they're wondering about leopard geckos on sand. Now, I'm personally on Instagram, and that seems to be a new – I don't know why debatable, but it's been a new topic recently in the past year or two that leopard geckos should not be on sand. Now, I obviously agree with that, so I just want to get your take on it. Should leopard geckos be on sand? because people are saying.
Well, I don't.
Since the environment.
I don't recommend it to the general public for sure. If you compact the sand down and everything, it would be fine. But the thing is, you got to make sure their supplementation is perfect. Because what they're doing when they get impacted like that, they're trying to get, you know, the supplements out of the sand. It's just something that they do. So if your supplementation isn't right, they're going to sit there and lick that sand up until they get impacted. A lot of people think that they're just chomping down a cricket or something. They get a little sand in there, it's going to cause them to get impacted, and that's just not true. They'll get, like pretty much any reptile, they're going to get some of the substrate or whatever in while they eat, you know. So I don't recommend it. It's not a good practice because a lot of people are going to screw up their supplementation in general. So you're going to see that issue. But if you had it on point and you had, you know, compact substrate, like really the sand issue, I find if you have the supplementation right, I find it problematic because they're not made for that kind of loose, like, you know, dune type of sand, really loose stuff. When you look at any type of gecko, you got to look at their toes to see what they're adapted to. So, like, leopard geckos have these claw-type toes, which are made for, you know, rocky outcrops and for climbing over things. And they live on hard, compact dirt, you know. And, of course, there's some loose substrate there or loose material. But they live in an area where they actually need to grip onto stuff and climb up rocks and climb over, you know, embankments and stuff.
Yeah, I think where most of this kind of, I don't know where it started, where people started letting their leopard geckos live on sand, but I think it comes more of people not being aware of geography, because people hear Syria or Iran and they think, oh, the desert, which is not the case. It's definitely not the case. So
yeah.
I think that's where
there is loose dirt and stuff in
geography class.
There is loose dirt and some sand there, but no, it's not a dune. So, you know, there's species that are, you know, you keep on sand because that's what they're made for. Like, you know, Synodactylus, a lot of those species and stuff need to be on sand and different things. It's fine to keep stuff on sand. It's just, you know, ideally you would keep them on a hard, compact type clay dirt substrate. Like, that's what they would naturally live on. And you'd have their supplementation perfect. If you don't have those, you know, you have to have that supplementation right. I never recommend it to the general public, though, just because not everybody's going to get the supplementation right. And then they're going to have more issues with the sand. So, but yeah, it's a general practice. Don't keep them on sand, you know, keep them on either hard type compact substrate or tile or paper towels or something, you know.
Yeah, definitely. All right. I want to thank you so much, John. I know this has been a little bit of a short episode, but we got some things to take care of. So thank you so much for coming on the show, and we look forward to welcoming you back maybe sometime next year if you would like.
Okay, yeah, sounds good.
All right. Once again, thank you. Thank you for coming on.
All right, thanks, Chris. Bye.
All right, guys. So basically, tonight, sadly, is our final episode of our 2016 season. I will call it a season from now on. It's the last show, so don't come looking for us next week, the week after that, next month, next week. Don't come looking for us. We're not going to be here until January 7th. Now, I told you guys that we will be moving to another different platform, but I decided to change my mind, and we're going to stay on this platform. However, we're going to upgrade, so we're going to be doing a whole entire revamp. You're going to be seeing us a lot more on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So catch us out over there. Our Instagram tag is at ESR Live. So don't forget to check us out over there. And once again, I want to thank you guys so much for giving us a warm welcome back to the reptile community on radio. So I hope that next year we will make it a great year, a full length year. I know this year has been a little short, but I promise you next year will be amazing. Now, for my final sign-off for this year, I wanted to wish everyone a happy holidays. If you're celebrating Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, or Christmas, have a happy, happy holidays with you and your family. And also, have a happy new year, because we will not be seeing you until January 7th. So it's a New Year tradition to play a certain song for the New Year, and that is always New York, New York by Frank Sinatra. So once again, even though this is not New Year's Eve, this is New Year's Eve for us. So once again, I love you all. Check us back here on January 7th, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 2017. I love you all. Good night.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that never sleeps. Up to you.